It's half past 8.
It's half past 8 New York time. Time to wake up America and stump the experts. Each week at this time, Lucky Strike presents Information Please. This is a weekly inquisition with you as the quizzers and a board of four know-it-alls as the quizzees. For every question we use, Lucky Strike pays out $10 plus a copy of the new Information Please quiz book. If your question stumps us, you get $25 more plus a 24-volume set of the current Encyclopedia Britannica. Send your questions to Information Please, 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. If our editorial staff edits your questions a bit, don't fret over it. In case of duplication, Information Please uses the question that was received first, and all questions become the property of Information Please. And now light up a lucky strike as I present our master of ceremonies, the literary critic of the New Yorker magazine, Clifton Fadiman. Mr. Fadiman.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, Information Please, as you know, is uncabined, uncribbed, and unconfined, free as the wind and go as you please. The four know-it-alls tonight are the versatile Oscar Levant, composer, pianist, author, motion picture actor, and insomniac, the light verse writer and conductor of that priceless American institution, the New York Post's conning tower, Mr. Franklin P. Adams, the sports expert who specializes in all knowledge, Mr. John Kieran, and Owen Davis, author of the new hit, Mr. and Mrs. North. Now remember, for each question that's missed, Lucky Strike rings up $25. It's paid out to the sender, plus 24 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Suppose we start the evening with a question coming to us from Joseph Boyle of New York City, and this is a question about famous actresses. Can you name a famous actress known for her beautiful or expressive back? Mr. Adams.
Wait a minute.
Back
to back.
Gordon.
Gordon, yes. What's the first name, Mr. Davis? Remember it, Mr. Levant?
Kitty.
Yes, Kitty Gordon was very famous for her back. Now, how about an actress known for her beautiful knees? Mm. Her beautiful knees, Mr. Levant?
Ann Pennington.
Ann Pennington, that's right. And how about hands, known for her beautiful or expressive hands? Think of any, Mr. Adams?
Ruth Gordon.
Well, I hadn't thought of it. That's quite possibly true. Mr. Davis, would you think that would be true of Ms. Gordon?
Alan Azimova.
Alan Azimova, yes. Mr. Levant?
Zazu Pitts.
Zazu Pitts, very good, yes. And perhaps most famous of all, the one of the greatest of them...
Hans Brinker.
Doozer. Now, how about a famous actress known for her beautiful or expressive... I think we better make this expressive... hips.
Expressive.
Expressive hips, yes.
American expressive, I have that.
Mr. Levant.
Mae West.
Mae West, yes. I should think that would be true. That gives us four actresses out of four, which is very good going at our age. The next question comes from Mrs. Winifred Kamen of New York City. This is a question about characters out of Dickens. Name the character from Dickens who was wooed by having vegetables thrown at her. I'm not kidding you, gentlemen. A character who was wooed by having vegetables thrown at her.
She must have struck out with the bases full.
Think of her. It's a character in Nicholas Nickleby. It's Mrs. Nickleby. There's an eccentric who lived across the way from, or used to throw cabbages and Brussels sprouts and so forth over the fence as a token of his esteem. Remember that, Mr. Davis? There's a smile on your face. The next character, that's one wrong, the next character from Dickens, ate eggs with the shells on them. I know this all sounds very improbable. Eggs with the shells on them. Who was that? Any idea? Yes, Mr. Kieran?
Was it the tame jackdaw in one of the Dickens books?
No. No, it's Mr. Quilp. Remember the monstrous Mr. Quilp in the old curiosity shop? Then the next Dickens character died of spontaneous combustion. Who was that?
Nobody on this program.
No, apparently not. Oh, you seem extinguished.
No, no.
Died of spontaneous combustion. Well, as Mr. Crooks in Bleak House. Mr. Davis, were you about to say that?
Bleak House. He swam the river to get away and then got into this little house and burned himself up.
Good enough, yes. I wish you'd come in just a second earlier, but I'm going to give you 100% credit on that. That's not enough, however. That means that Lucky Strike will send out $25 to Mrs. Kamen instead of the Britannica. Thank you. Now, here's a question from Mr. J.A. Moore of Philadelphia. Get 3 out of 4 on this, if you can. Name the sources of the following quotations and tell what's happening at the time. These are all quotations about
various times. One, quote, "It was two by the village clock," close quote. Where's it come from? What was happening? Mr. Davis?
That's the Paul Revere.
You bet. And what was happening at 2 o'clock in Paul Revere's ride, remember?
He was waiting to carry the news. No, it was one.
Yes.
He was waiting at one. At two, he was riding through Concord.
That's right. He came to Concord Town at two. That's very good going, Mr. Davis. Thank you very much. Now, the next one is about midnight. It was midnight on the waters. Mr. Adams.
And a storm was on the deep.
True enough. And where did all this happen?
That was when we were crowded in the cabin.
Yes, and the name of the poem?
The Tempest.
Is it The Tempest or is it The Captain's Daughter?
It's called The Tempest by James T. Field.
It's by James T. Field. I have The Captain's Daughter down here. Am I wrong?
You're wrong.
Okay, that settles that. We'll compromise. I'm wrong. Three. It's half past eight. Mr. Adams?
That's what it was a little while ago, New York time.
Yes, when what important thing happened, Mr. Adams?
When this program started.
Yes, don't be modest. That's quite true. Can you say it the way it should be said?
I ain't got that dialect.
I'd love to get somebody to volunteer to do that. Mr. Levan, can you?
I'll do the first part.
All right.
It's half past eight.
No.
I think you boys are terrible. Do you mind if I get Mr. Speed Riggs up here to do it for us as it should be done?
That was a very unlucky strike, I would call it.
Speed, do you want to show us how it should be done?
It's half past eight. Half past eight.
Thank you very much, Speed. Actually, it's 8:36 and a half.
That's
harmonica. The clock struck one. Mr. Kieran.
Down he run, hickory dickory dock.
Good enough. Who was it who ran?
The mouse.
The mouse, yes. He ran down very ungrammatically, didn't he?
He certainly did.
He should have ran. Should have run. He ran. That gives us four times out of four times. Now, the next one is a musical question. It comes from Mrs. Helen Ranson of Parkland, Washington. Get two out of three. All you have to do is name the symphonic compositions from which these transitional passages are taken. We're going to have three transitional passages played for us, and we have to try to identify the composition, symphony in each case. Let's have the first. Mr. Levant?
It's half past eight. Wait a minute. Da-dee-da. That's, I think, in the... It's the unfinished symphony.
That's right. Thank you very much, Mr. Levant. I think that's pretty good going. Shall we have the second transitional passage?
I can't get half past eight on my head.
Too late now.
It's some tune. Next, one more bar and I got it.
Does that
start
give it
on
away?
A B flat, the next bar?
I'll have it played
the
again
next bar.
For you.
No, I don't play it.
No, you can't bribe me, Mr. Levant. You got any idea? Want to guess?
Yeah, pa-pum. Is that the next bar?
Don't tell him.
He can't tell me.
All your charm can't do it, Mr. Levant.
No, if it's yap-bop-bom, that would be the Brahms Symphony. But if it isn't yam-bom-bom, I don't know what it is.
It's the Brahms Symphony.
Joe, ask him to play the next bar.
It's the Brahms first. Well, you're right, Mr. Levant. I'm giving you full credit on it.
The next bar.
It's the Brahms first.
Well, then I was... The yam-bom-bom didn't come on the next bar.
Pretty hard supplying you with bum-bum-bum at the proper time. Shall we have the third of these transitional passages? There's no bump-bump-bumps in that, Mr. Levan.
No.
I think we're stuck.
It's vaguely familiar, but to put what they call my finger on it, I don't think Lucky Strike can afford that much time.
Go ahead. Give us an idea. Would you like to guess?
It's in a major key so far.
That's all we're going to do for you.
Yeah?
Yep. I'm sorry.
You don't want me to play the whole piece? Or
no,
take a half
no. That I can't do. It's the first movement of Tchaikovsky's Pathétique.
You won't play the next bar for me now?
I'm awfully sorry. I think it's a tough question. Mm. And that's going to send, courtesy of Lucky Strike, $25 to Mrs. Ranson, together with a copy of the Britannica.
And the next question comes from Harry Koretsky of Brooklyn, New York. Can you give me four famous books or plays whose titles make mention of anything found in the kitchen, but not foods, if you don't mind? The Melting Pot by Israel Zangwill would be an example. Mr. Kieran.
Peter Pan by Day Barron.
That's a very good one. Right. Mr. Levant.
There was a book by Broom Street by Clement Stane. It's about the theater.
Broom Stages. Broom Stages by Clement Stane. It's about the theater. Isn't that right, Mr. Davis? Wasn't there such a book?
Broom Stages, yes.
Yes, I think that's true. Broom, very good. That gives us two. It gives the pan and the broom. Furnish this kitchen more quickly, gentlemen.
What do you hear from the mop?
Not a word from her.
That's Harvard, that's
all. Any more? Mr. Kieran.
The Midnight Bell. There's a bell in every kitchen.
Well, I'm not so sure there's a bell in every kitchen. The Midnight Bell, who wrote it?
Gosh, I know, it was old Stock Bell.
A Midnight Bell.
Mr. Davis?
Written by Charles Hoyt, but there's one called The Pot and the Kettle.
That's good. That gives us two. Very good. Who wrote The Pot and the Kettle, or was it a collaboration? Sounds like it.
No, it's an old farce, many, many years old.
Well, then let's figure Pot and Kettle as two, shall we? Can we get one more, Mr. Levant?
I know one not long ago. Broken Dishes by Martin Flavin.
That's a good one. Very good. Sink or Swim by Horatio Alger.
Hey.
The next one from Mrs. Walter D. Montgomery of San Antonio, Texas. Listen carefully, gentlemen. What animal could still be reproduced if not one of its kind were left alive? Don't look at me that way, gentlemen. That's what it says on the card here. What animal could still be reproduced if not one of its kind were left alive? Mr. Kieran.
Well, are you going into the bees again?
No, I'm off bees. I think we've exhausted the bees.
Well, do you mean the Ornithorhynchus paradoxus?
Oh, don't say that.
Well,
Mr.
a duck-billed platypus.
I beg pardon?
A duck-billed platypus, but it would have to be very fast work because the egg hatches almost as soon as it's laid.
But that it would still be alive, though. But suppose not one of its offspring, one of its kind were alive.
Well, if you killed all the adult
nobody would
waddling about duck-billed platypuses and platypi and had one egg.
Yes.
Well, that'd hatch.
Well, that would be true of any animal, wouldn't it? Mr. Levant?
Is that the nickel with the buffalo on it you're talking about?
No. I'm thinking of mules. See, mules are the offspring of mares and donkeys, but if there wasn't a single mule left alive, but enough mares and enough donkeys who were willing to cooperate, you could still have mules. Isn't that true?
Are they self-propagating, gentlemen?
I think that's a very good question, quite worthy of $25, which goes out to Mrs. Montgomery plus a set of the Britannica. And now let's see where we are. So far, Lucky Strike has paid out, $75 and three sets of the Britannica. And now Mr. Cross will demonstrate for us that a straight line is the shortest path between two points.
It's an American habit to go straight to the point, not to beat around the bush. That's why Lucky Strike is bringing you actual market reports on tobacco, to show you that we consistently pay higher prices to get the finer, the lighter, the naturally milder leaf. For example, at the Morristown, Tennessee tobacco auctions, latest reports show that the American Tobacco Company has paid 32% more per pound for the tobacco it bought for its cigarettes and other tobacco products. Yes, 32% above the average market price paid for all the various types and grades of tobacco sold there. And the best we bought will go to Lucky's. Well, that's really getting down to brass tacks on the subject of cigarettes, isn't it? Reports like this show you why more and more level-headed Americans are turning to Lucky's for a cigarette of finer, lighter, naturally milder tobaccos.
Mr. Cross, you went straight to the point in exactly 53 seconds. And now we'll begin the second half of the program this evening with a question from Lewis Lounsbury of Stone Ridge, New York. And I have four characters of literature here on the card. I want you to tell me who they were. Get three out of four. The first was called The Artful Dodger. Mr. Davis.
Oliver Twist.
It wasn't Oliver Twist who was the Artful Dodger.
No, but in the novel, Oliver Twist...
Yes?
He was one of the thieves that Oliver was thrown with.
Yes, and why was he called that? What was his specialty?
He was a trained pickpocket.
A trained pickpocket, yes, exactly. Very clever, dexterous young pickpocket. Very good, Mr. Davis. Now, how about the next one? The Double Dealer. This isn't a character from Dickens. The Double Dealer. Mr. Adams.
That's the name of a magazine.
Published in New Orleans some years ago, that's true. But it's a character also, a character in English literature.
In a play. In a restoration play. In a restoration play by a man named Congreve.
Love for Love.
I think it's just called The Double Dealer. The play is called The Double Dealer, and the character, a man named Maskwell, is also known as The Double Dealer. That's one wrong. Now I have to get the next two right.
Cheers.
Identify the unsocial socialist. The unsocial socialist. Mr. Levant.
I know the book by George Bernard Shaw.
Right. And who is the unsocial socialist?
Well, there were
book?
Two characters in there that kind of took me. One was a character called Smilash that Shaw wrote about in choosing his name. Thought it was the most optimistic name. It's a combination of smile and lash.
Good enough. That, of course, has nothing to do with the question, but it's very interesting information.
The other fellow had a name like Dreyfus or...
That's good enough. Trefusis. Sidney Trefusis was the unsocial socialist. He's the hero of the book.
Yeah, but the other fellow had a nicer name.
Apparently you stick to it. At least you're finished with 8:30, Mr. Levant. We're getting on. How about the gentle grafter? Mr. Kieran.
Well, that was a character of O. Henry, in O. Henry's book.
Yes? You know his name?
Well, that was the name of the book. I don't recall his name.
Jeff,
Remember it?
Jeff something.
Jeff Peters, I think, and his pal Andy Tucker. I guess it was Jeff Peters in the collection of short stories called The Gentle Grafter, who was The Gentle Grafter. That gives us 3 out of 4 and sends us on to this question from Mrs. E. Scheinfeld of Milwaukee, Pennsylvania. What are the residents of the following cities officially known as? Well, for example, in this city, we're called New Yorkers. Residents of Chicago are called Chicagoans.
Is Milwaukee in Pennsylvania?
It says on the card, Milwaukee's in Pennsylvania. It may have moved. It's a very lively city. How about Albany? What are the people of Albany called? Mr. Adams?
Albanians.
Albanians. And what are the people of Phoenix, Arizona called? Mr. Kieran?
I'd call them Phoenicians.
You bet. That would be quite right. Phoenicians is right. Phoenicians. And what are the people of Los Angeles called? People of Los Angeles.
The nickname, you mean?
Are there nicknames, Mr. Levant?
Say you're on the air, boy.
Mr. Levant?
Well, it's a city of angels. And
yes?
Takes in both sexes, I guess.
Oh, sure.
Angels.
Well, that's true.
The
they
baseball
do call,
them,
they do call
the
themselves angels sometimes, but there's a regular name, a more formal name, just as we call ourselves New Yorkers.
Is it
Los Angelians?
No, that's not it.
It sounds like a...
Mr. Kieran, I thought you had it.
Los Angelesians.
No, that's terrible.
What?
No, you're just guessing. You're going to hear from Los Angeles in the morning. Los Angelenos. Los Angelenos, which I may be mispronouncing, but at any rate, that's the way in which it's spelled.
Is that what they call themselves?
Yeah, that's what they call themselves in their off moments. That gives us 2 out of 3. The next question comes from Frederick A. Maitala of Monroe, Wisconsin. This is a question about wills. You know, the things you leave, if you're lucky, after you die. Can you name the book or play in which these wills figured prominently? I'm going to explain them. Get 2 out of 3. In the first will, the citizens of a city are made the heirs. Mr. Kieran.
Julius Caesar's will.
That's right. Do you remember the will?
Yes.
We'll have the will.
Good. And what happens after that? What did the will say?
The will left to each citizen a certain sum of money in the use of his gardens and all.
Right.
A lot of added stuff.
I think that's very accurate. To every Roman citizen, he gives to every several man 75 drachmas. I don't see why you should remember just how many, Mr. Kieran. Now, here's the second will. In this case, a football star inherited a fashionable dressmaking establishment. Mr. Levant.
That's in Roberta.
It is in Roberta, yes. It's the musical comedy Roberta. I think that's pretty good going.
By Hoback and Kern.
Good enough. Now, here's a hard one. Here's a will in which a man named Snivy left $2 to the city of Venice, Italy, on condition that the name be changed to Snivyville. Now, why anybody should know that, I haven't the remotest idea. Well, it says down here that Mr. Dooley... Mr. F.P. Dunn's character, Mr. Dooley, in an essay called On Making a Will, has a character called The Will of Ephraim Snivy. And this will says, to the mayor of Venice, Italy, I lay up $2 to erect a monument to me and alter the name of the town to Snivyville. Do you remember that, Mr. Adams?
I remember that, but I didn't know it was in Swedish dialect.
It's the best I can do on short notice. Well, that gives us 1, 2 out of 3, which is all we were required to get. Now, the next one comes from M.R. Werner of Madison Avenue of this city. Again, get 2 out of 3 if you can. This is a question about famous traitors. Where did these men who were accused of being traitors die? The first one is Benedict Arnold. Where did he die? Mr. Kieran.
I believe he died in London.
Yes, he died in England. I'm not sure what the city was.
I think it's London. There's a poem written about his dying words and so forth. A dreadful lesson to all of us.
That's right. And the second traitor, Aaron Burr, died where? Mr. Levant?
I think it was in New York.
Yes, right here in New York City. I don't know what street. Do you know, Mr. Adams?
He had a roundabout way of coming back.
He went to where? Texas.
He went to
first?
England first, you see. I think he went abroad, after the duel with Alexander Hamilton. He was in disgrace. Then he had that thing down in Louisiana about Mexico, and again he was in disgrace.
Oh.
And a few more disgraces, and before you know it, he was someplace.
Back in New York.
No, he was abroad first, and then he came back to New York.
And he died right here in the city.
Of a very old age, too.
Yes, he was.
Very old.
He was very old. Yeah. He was very
Life
old.
Of Aaron Burr by Oscar Levant.
Short and sweet. The third is the character Brutus. Brutus, connected with Mr. J. Caesar. Where did he die, Mr. Kieran?
He died at Philippi.
Yes, under what circumstances?
He killed himself.
How did he do it?
He ran upon his sword.
That's very good. Thank you, Mr. Adams. Mr. Kieran, and where is Philippi?
Well, it's over across that sea where Mr. Mussolini is having a little trouble now.
You mean near in Albania?
Well, it's over in that direction.
Yes, it is. I guess it's in what we call Macedonia now, or some part of the Balkan Peninsula. Now, the next question comes from Mark Williams of Des Moines, Iowa. Get 3 out of 4. Here's a question. Here are a set of quotations. All about seeing different things. What was seen in each of them? Here's the first. All I could see from where I stood was... Well, it really amounts to completing the quotation, you see. All I could see from where I stood was...
The right fielder's head.
That may become just as famous as this quotation, which is from Miss Millay's poem, called Renaissance. All I could see from where I stood was 3 long mountains and a wood. Mr. Adams, did you remember that?
No.
Well, that's one wrong. Now, the next one. I looked over Jordan, and what did I see? Well, what did I see? Looked over Jordan, and what did I see, Mr.
Come
Adams?
Come for to carry me home.
Better
yes,
not sing, Mr.
Yes,
Adams.
That's not bad.
Chariot.
Yes. A little hard to get that Swedish accent of yours, Mr. Adams.
But
what did he see, actually?
Something about angels, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes. Mr. Levant, what did he say?
Coming after me.
Yes, a band of angels coming after me. The famous Negro spiritual, Swing Low. Now, how about this one? With eagle eyes he stared, and what did he see when he stared? Mr. Kieran.
At the broad Pacific, and all his men gazed at each other with a wild surmise, silent upon a peak in Darien.
That's pretty going.
I'm first looking into Chapman's Homer by John Keats.
I think you got the... That's right. Very good. That's perfect. And what's the famous error in that poem?
Famous error is that he should not have said Cortez.
Should have said instead?
Balboa.
Balboa, yes. But the poem has remained immortal nevertheless. It shows you don't have to be correct in poetry, Mr. Kieran, doesn't it? I think that's pretty good going. I'll see what we can do with this fourth and last. When I dipped into the future, far as human eye could see, saw... I have how many hands here? Was that your hand, Mr. Adams?
That's my hand.
Did you put it down or did you put it up?
Well, yes and no. It's from Locksley Hall.
It is from Locksley Hall. But and what was seen in that quotation? Remember, Mr. Kieran?
A lot of airships.
Among the heavens, airy navies grappling in the central blue.
That's a part of the vision that Tennyson says he saw.
Well, it was a big vision.
It was a big vision. The vision of the world and all the wonder that would be from Tennyson's Locksley Hall. I think that's very good going on that question. Now we'll have time for this one from Edith Richman of this city. This, I think, is a rather easy question. That's the first one I could have answered myself this evening. Name 3 sports which do not take place on level playing fields. 3 sports which don't take place on level playing fields.
How about uphill and over dale, you mean?
That's all right. Cross country running.
Why run? You can walk uphill.
You can walk, sure. You can stagger. Mr. Kieran.
Well, skiing.
Skiing, sure. That gives us 2.
Bobsledding.
Yeah.
Yes, bobsledding. That's right. Sort of associated. Let's get 1 or 2 more.
Oh, yeah.
Mr. Adams, do you have one?
No, but it'll probably be on that tennis court you build.
Well, I was thinking of mountain climbing.
Is that a sport?
Yes, it's a sport. You try it. How about golf? Mr. Kieran, golf isn't on level ground, is it?
Yes.
That's a real estate problem.
I mean, it is not on level ground.
It is not on level ground, yes, but that gives us three or four. Tobogganing, as you say. J. Bennett Hill of Wynwood, Pennsylvania, sends this one in. What works of fact or fiction have for their settings the following countries? Get three out of four. And now the first country is the country of Nepenthe, N-E-P-E-N-T-H-E. These might conceivably be imaginary, of course. Mr. Kieran?
You mean where that country is mentioned?
Yes. In what literary work?
In the Poe's Raven.
Nepenthe?
Yes. Respite and Nepenthe and forget the lost Lenore.
Yes, but isn't that a drink?
No.
No?
No.
No, I thought it was a drink.
No, that's Lethe.
That's your error.
That's
all
Lethe.
All right. Each man has his error. I was thinking that it was the locale of Norman Douglas's novel, South Wind.
You save us a lot of money being over there.
I know, I'm very happy. Here's the second country, Marsovia. Marsovia, M-A-R-S-O-V-I-A, Mr. Levant.
I think that's the Leha thing, the Merry Widow.
Good, good. And that is before your time, too, Mr. Levant.
Before my time.
Good.
It's been revived and Lubitsch did it as a picture.
Oh, you saw it again. Oh, I was thinking of it as it first appeared when Mr. Adams was a boy.
As opposed to
how
what?
How about Uz? Well, that's in Job. And how about Tomania?
Tomania.
Yes, Mr. Kieran?
Ring Lardner?
No, it's the great dictator, as Mr. Levant was going to tell us. I think we'll send $25 to Mr. Hill, shall we? And now here's Mr. Cross with a word about supply and demand.
The demand, Mr. Fadiman, is everybody's demand today for a mild smoke. Now, that demand draws upon America's supply of the finer, the lighter, the naturally milder leaf. So what's the result? Well, that kind of tobacco is bid up higher at the auctions. That's why it's important for smokers to know the actual tobacco market figures, such as I quoted to you a few minutes ago, to know that Lucky Strike pays the necessary higher prices to get the finer, lighter, milder tobaccos. So when you consider the question of mildness, remember this. At auction after auction, independent tobacco experts see Lucky's pay the price to get the finer, the lighter, the naturally milder tobaccos, and they smoke Lucky's 2-to-1. Why not profit by their experience? For a really mild cigarette, ask for Lucky Strike.
Thanks, Mr. Cross. This evening, Lucky Strike cheerfully pays out $100 and four sets of the Britannica. Thank you, Mr. Davis, for coming down tonight. Next week, Mr. Kieran and Mr. Adams will be on hand, and we'll have an unusual combination of guests. Warden Laws of Sing Sing, returning by popular request, and the amiable Boris Karloff. Now appearing in Broadway's smash hit, Arsenic and Old Lace. Remember, for every question we use, whether or not it's answered correctly, the sender gets $10. If the question stumps ups, you get not only $25 more, but in addition, the complete 24-volume set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Send your letters with questions and correct answers to Information, Please, 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. And now a parting message from Mr. L.A. Speed Riggs, famous tobacco auctioneer of Goldsboro, North Carolina.
And that chant, fully interpreted, ladies and gentlemen, means Lucky's pay higher prices for the finer, the lighter, the naturally milder tobaccos. With independent tobacco experts, auctioneers, buyers, warehouse men, with men who know tobacco best, it's Lucky's 2-to-1.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.